You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 1. It was in the little office of James T. Fields, over the bookstore of Ticknor and Fields, at 124 Tremont Street, Boston, that I first met my friend of now 44 years, Samuel L. Clemens. Mr. Fields was then the editor of the Atlantic Monthly, and I was his proud and glad assistant, with a pretty free hand as to manuscripts, and an unmanacled command of the book notices at the end of the magazine. I wrote nearly all of them myself, and in 1869 I had written rather a long notice of a book just winning its way to universal favor. In this review I had intimated my reservations concerning the Innocents Abroad. But I had the luck, if not the sense, to recognize that it was such fun as we had not had before. I forget just what I said in praise of it, and it does not matter. It is enough that I praised it enough to satisfy the author. He now signified as much, and he stamped his gratitude into my memory with a story wonderfully allegorizing the situation, which the mock modesty of print forbids my repeating here. Throughout my long acquaintance with him, his graphic touch was always allowing itself a freedom which I cannot bring my fainter pencil to illustrate. He had the Southwestern, the Lincolnian, the Elizabethan breath of parlance, which, I suppose, one ought not to call coarse without calling oneself prudish. And I was often hiding away, in discreet holes and corners, the letters in which he had loosed his bold fancy to stoop on rank suggestion. I could not bear to burn them, and I could not, after the first reading, quite bear to look at them. I shall best give my feeling on this point by saying that in it he was Shakespearean, or, if his ghost will not suffer me the word, then he was Baconian. At the time of our first meeting, which must have been well toward the winter, Clemens, as I must call him instead of Mark Twain, which seemed always, somehow, to mask him from my personal sense, was wearing a sealskin coat, with the fur out, in the satisfaction of a caprice, or the love of strong effect which he was apt to indulge through life. I do not know what droll comment was in Field's mind with respect to this garment, but, probably, he felt that here was an original who was not to be brought to any Bostonian book in the judgment of his vivid qualities. With his crest of dense red hair and the wide sweep of his flaming mustache, Clemens was not discordantly clothed in that sealskin coat, which afterward, in spite of his own warmth in it, sent the cold chills through me when I once accompanied it down Broadway and shared the immense publicity it won him. He had always a relish for personal effect, which expressed itself in the white suit of complete serge which he wore in his last years, and in the Oxford gown which he put on for every possible occasion, and said he would like to wear it all the time. That was not vanity in him, but a keen feeling for costume, which the severity of our modern tailoring forbids men, though it flatters women to every excess in it. Yet he also enjoyed the shock, the offense, the pang which it gave the sensibilities of others. Then there were times he played these pranks for pure fun and for the pleasure of the witness. Once, I remember seeing him come into his drawing-room at Hartford in a pair of white cowskin slippers, with the hair out, and do a crippled colored uncle, to the joy of all beholders. Or, I must not say all, for I remember also the dismay of Mrs. Clemens, and her low, despairing cry of, "Ho, youth!" That was her name for him among their friends, and it fitted him as no other would. Though I fancied with her it was a shrinking from his baptismal Samuel, or the vernacular Sam of his earlier companionships. He was a youth to the end of his days, the heart of a boy with the head of a sage, the heart of a good boy, or a bad boy, but always a willful boy, and willfulest to show himself out at every time for just the boy he was. End of chapter 1. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California for LibriVox. Fall 2006. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 2. There is a gap in my recollection of Clemens, which I think is of a year or two, for the next thing I remember of him is meeting him at a lunch in Boston, given us by that genius of hospitality, the tragically destined Ralph Keeler, author of one of the most unjustly forgotten books, Vagabond's Adventures, a true bit of picaresque autobiography. Keeler never had any money, to the general knowledge, and he never borrowed, and he could not have had credit at the restaurant where he invited us to feast at his expense. There was T.B. Aldrich, there was J.T. Fields, much the oldest of our company, who had just freed himself from the trammels of the publishing business, and was feeling his freedom in every word. There was Bret Harte, who had lately come east in his princely progress from California. And there was Clemens. Nothing remains to me of the happy time but a sense of idle and aimless and joyful talk-play, beginning and ending nowhere, of eager laughter, of countless good stories from Fields, of a heat-lightning shimmer of wit from Aldrich, of an occasional concentration of our joint mockeries upon our host, who took it gladly. And amid the discourse, so little improving, but so full of good fellowship, Bret Harte's fleeting dramatization of Clemens' mental attitude toward a symposium of Boston illuminates. "Why, fellows," he spluttered, "this is the dream of Mark's life." And I remember the glance from under Clemens' feathery eyebrows, which betrayed his enjoyment of the fun. We had beefsteak with mushrooms, which in recognition of their shape, Aldrich hailed as shoe pegs. And to crown the feast, we had an omelette souse, which the waiter brought in flat as a pancake. Amid our shouts of congratulations to poor Keeler, who took them with appreciative submission. It was, in every way, what a Boston literary lunch ought not to have been in the popular ideal which Harte attributed to Clemens. Our next meeting was at Hartford, or rather at Springfield, where Clemens greeted us on the way to Hartford. Aldrich was going on to be his guest, and I was going to be Charles Dudley Warner's, but Clemens had come part way to welcome us both. In the good fellowship of that cordial neighborhood, we had two such days as the aging sun no longer shines on in his round. There was constant running in and out of friendly houses, where the lively hosts and guests called one another by their Christian names or nicknames, and no such vain ceremony as knocking or ringing at doors. Clemens was then building the stately mansion in which he satisfied his love of magnificence as if it had been another sealskin coat. And he was at the crest of the prosperity which enabled him to humor every whim or extravagance. The house was the design of that most original artist, Edward Potter, who once, when hard-pressed by incompetent curiosity for the name of his style in a certain church, proposed that it should be called the English Violet Order of Architecture. And this house was so absolutely suited to the owner's humor that I suppose there never was another house like it. But its character must be for recognition farther along in these reminiscences. The vividest impression which Clemens gave us two ravenous young Boston authors was of the satisfying, the surfeiting nature of subscription publication. An army of agents was overrunning the country with the prospectuses of his books, and delivering them by the scores of thousands in completed sale. Of the Innocents Abroad, he said, "It sells right along just like the Bible," and Roughing It was swiftly following, without perhaps ever quite overtaking it in popularity. But he lectured Aldrich and me on the folly of that mode of publication in the trade which he had thought it the highest success to achieve a chance in. "Anything but subscription publication is printing for private circulation," he maintained, and he so won upon our greed and hope that on the way back to Boston we planned the joint authorship of a volume adapted to subscription publication. We got a very good name for it, as we believed, in Memorable Murders, and we never got farther with it, but by the time we reached Boston we were rolling in wealth so deep that we could hardly walk home in the frugal fashion by which we still thought it best to spare car fare. Carriage fare we did not dream of even in that opulence. End of chapter 2. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California, fall 2006. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 3. The visits to Hartford, which had begun with this affluence, continued without actual increase of riches for me, but now I went alone, and in Warner's European and Egyptian absences I formed the habit of going to Clemens. By this time he was in his new house, where he used to give me a royal chamber on the ground floor, and come in at night, after I had gone to bed, to take off the burglar alarm, so that the family should not be roused if anybody tried to get in at my window. This would be after we had sat up late, he smoking the last of his innumerable cigars, and soothing his tense nerves with a mild hot scotch, while we both talked and talked and talked, of everything in the heavens and on the earth, and the waters under the earth. After 2 days of this talk, I would come away hollow, realizing myself best in the image of one of those locust shells, which you find sticking to the bark of trees at the end of summer. Once, after some such bout of brains, we went down to New York together, and sat facing each other in the Pullman smoker without passing a syllable, till we had occasion to say, "Well, we're here." Then, with our installation in a now vanished hotel, the Old Brunswick, to be specific, the talk began again with the inspiration of the novel environment, and went on and on. We wished to be asleep, but he could not stop, and he lounged through the rooms in the long nightgown which he always wore in preference to the pajamas which he despised, and told the story of his life. The inexhaustible, the fairy, the Arabian Nights story, which I could never tire of, even when it began to be told over again. Or at times he would reason high, of providence, foreknowledge, will, and fate, fixed fate, free will, foreknowledge absolute, walking up and down, and halting now and then, with the fine toss and slant of his shaggy head, as some bold thought or splendid joke struck him. He was, in those days, a constant attendant at the church of his great friend, the Reverend Joseph H. Twitchell, and, at least tacitly, far from the entire negation he came to at last. I should say he had hardly yet examined the grounds of his passive acceptance of his wife's belief, for it was hers and not his, and he held it unscanned in the beautiful and tender loyalty to her which was the most moving quality of his most faithful soul. I make bold to speak of the love between them, because without it I could not make him known to others as he was known to me. It was a greater part of him than the love of most men for their wives, and she merited all the worship he could give her, all the devotion, all the implicit obedience, by her surpassing force and beauty of character. She was, in a way, the loveliest person I have ever seen, the gentlest, the kindest, without a touch of weakness. She united wonderful tact with wonderful truth, and Clemens not only accepted her rule implicitly, but he rejoiced, he gloried in it. I am not sure that he noticed all her goodness in the actions that made it a heavenly vision to others. He had so the habit of her goodness. But if there was any forlorn and helpless creature in the room, Mrs. Clemens was somehow promptly at his side or hers. She was always seeking occasion of kindness to those in her household or out of it. She loved to let her heart go beyond the reach of her hand, and imagined the whole hard and suffering world with compassion for its structural as well as incidental wrongs. I suppose she had her ladyhood limitations, her female fears of etiquette and convention, but she did not let them hamper the wild and splendid generosity with which Clemens rebelled against the social stupidities and cruelties. She had been a lifelong invalid when he met her, and he liked to tell the beautiful story of their courtship to each new friend whom he found capable of feeling its beauty or worthy of hearing it. Naturally, her father had hesitated to give her into the keeping of the young, strange Westerner, who had risen up out of the unknown with his giant reputation of burlesque humorist and demanded guarantees, demanded proofs. "He asked me," Clemens would say, "if I couldn't give him the names of people who knew me in California, and when it was time to hear from them, I heard from him." "Well, Mr. Clemens, nobody seems to have a kind word for you." "I hadn't referred him to people that I thought were going to whitewash me. I thought it was all up for me, but I was disappointed. So, I guess I shall have to back you myself," he said. Whether this made him faithfuler to the trust put in him, I cannot say, but probably not. It was always in him to be faithful to any trust, and in proportion as a trust of his own was betrayed, he was ruthlessly and implacably resentful. But I wish now to speak of the happiness of that household in Hartford, which responded so perfectly to the ideals of the mother when the three daughters, so lovely and so gifted, were yet little children. There had been a boy. "And, yes, I killed him," Clemens once said, with the unsparing self-blame in which he would wreak an unavailing regret. He meant that he had taken the child out imprudently, and the child had taken the cold, which he died of. But it was by no means certain this was through its father's imprudence. I never heard him speak of his son except that once, but no doubt in his deep heart his loss was irreparably present. He was a very tender father, and delighted in the minds of his children, but he was wise enough to leave their training altogether to the wisdom of their mother. He left them to that in everything, keeping for himself the pleasure of teaching them little scenes of drama, learning languages with them, and leading them in singing. They came to the table with their parents, and could have set him an example in behavior when, in moments of intense excitement, he used to leave his place and walk up and down the room, flying his napkin and talking and talking. It was after his first English sojourn that I used to visit him, and he was then full of praise of everything English. The English personal independence and public spirit, and hospitality, and truth. He liked to tell stories in proof of their virtues, but he was not blind to the defects of their virtues, their submissive acceptance of caste, their callousness with strangers, their bluntness with one another. Mrs. Clemens had been, in a way, to suffer socially more than he, and she praised the English less. She had sat after dinner with ladies who snubbed and ignored one another, and left her to find her own amusement in the absence of the attention with which Americans perhaps cloy their guests, but which she could not help preferring. In their successive sojourns among them, I believe he came to like the English less, and she more. The fine delight of his first acceptance among them did not renew itself till his Oxford degree was given him. Then it made his cup run over, and he was glad the whole world should see it. His wife would not chill the ardor of his early Anglomania, and in this, as in everything, she wished to humor him to the utmost. No one could have realized more than she his essential fineness, his innate nobleness. Marriages are what the parties to them alone really know them to be. But from the outside, I should say that this marriage was one of the most perfect. It lasted in his absolute devotion to the day of her death, that delayed long in cruel suffering, and that left one side of him in lasting night. From Florence there came to me heartbreaking letters from him about the torture she was undergoing, and at last a letter saying she was dead, with the simple-hearted cry, "I wish I was with Livy." I do not know why I have left saying till now that she was a very beautiful woman, classically regular in features, with black hair smooth over her forehead, and with tenderly peering myopic eyes, always behind glasses, and a smile of angelic kindness. But this kindness went with a sense of humor which qualified her to appreciate the self-lawed genius of a man who will be remembered with the great humorous of all time, with Cervantes, with Swift, or with any others worthy his company. None of them was his equal in humanity. End of Chapter 3. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California, Fall 2006. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. That's LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 4. Clemens had appointed himself, with the architect's connivance, a luxurious study over the library in his new house. But as his children grew older, this study, with its carved and cushioned armchairs, was given over to them for a schoolroom, and he took the room above his stable, which had been intended for his coachman. There we used to talk together, when we were not walking and talking together, until he discovered that he could make a more commodious use of the billiard room at the top of his house, for the purposes of literature and friendship. It was pretty cold up there in the early spring and late fall weather with which I chiefly associate the place, but by lighting up all the gas burners and kindling a reluctant fire on the hearth, we could keep it well above freezing. Clemens could also push the balls about, and, without rivalry from me, who could no more play billiards than smoke, could win endless games of pool, while he carried points of argument against imaginable differers in opinion. Here he wrote many of his tales and sketches, and, for anything I know, some of his books. I particularly remember his reading me here his first rough sketch of Captain Stormfield's Visit to Heaven, with the real name of the captain, whom I knew already from his many stories about him. We had a peculiar pleasure in looking off from the high windows on the pretty Hartford landscape, and down from them into the tops of the trees clothing the hillside by which his house stood. We agreed that there was a novel charm in trees, seen from such a vantage, far surpassing that of the farther scenery. He had not been a country boy for nothing. Rather, he had been a country boy, or still better, a village boy, for everything that nature can offer the young of our species, and no aspect of her was lost on him. We were natives of this same vast Mississippi Valley, and Missouri was not so far from Ohio, but that we were akin in our first knowledges of woods and fields as we were in our early parlance. I had outgrown the use of mine through my greater bookishness, but I gladly recognized the phrases which he employed for their lasting juiciness and the long-remembered savor they had on his mental palate. I have elsewhere sufficiently spoken of his unsophisticated use of words, of the diction which forms the backbone of his manly style. If I mention my own greater bookishness, by which I mean his less quantitative reading, it is to give myself better occasion to note that he was always reading some vital book. It might be some out-of-the-way book, but it had the root of the human matter in it, a volume of great trials, one of the supreme autobiographies, a signal passage of history, a narrative of travel, a story of captivity, which gave him life at first hand. As I remember, he did not care much for fiction, and in that sort he had certain distinct loathings. There were certain authors whose names he seemed not so much to pronounce as to spew out of his mouth. Goldsmith was one of these, but his prime abhorrence was my dear and honored prime favorite, Jane Austen. He once said to me, I suppose after he had been reading some of my unsparing praises of her, I am always praising her, "You seem to think that woman could write." And he forbore withering me with his scorn, apparently because we had been friends so long, and he more pitied than hated me for my bad taste. He seemed not to have any preferences among novelists, or at least I never heard him express any. He used to read the modern novels I praised, in or out of print, but I do not think he much liked reading fiction. As for plays, he detested the theater, and said he would as lief do a sum as follow a plot on the stage. He could not, or did not, give any reasons for his literary abhorrences, and perhaps he really had none. But he could have said very distinctly, if he had needed, why he liked the books he did. I was away at the time of his great Browning passion, and I know of it chiefly from hearsay. But at the time, Tolstoy was doing what could be done to make me over. Clemens wrote, "That man seems to have been to you what Browning was to me." I do not know that he had other favorites among the poets, but he had very favorite poems, which he liked to read to you, and he read, of course, splendidly. I have forgotten what piece of John Hayes it was that he liked so much, but I remembered how he fiercely reveled in the vengefulness of William Morris's Sir Guy of the Dolorous Blast, and how he especially exulted in the lines which tell of the supposed speaker's joy in slaying the murderer of his brother. "I am 80 years, and my hair is nigh turned gray, but I am glad to think of the moment when I took his life away." Generally, I fancy his pleasure in poetry was not great, and I do not believe he cared much for the conventionally accepted masterpieces of literature. He liked to find out good things and great things for himself. Sometimes he would discover these in a masterpiece new to him alone, and then, if you brought his ignorance home to him, he enjoyed it, and enjoyed it the more you rubbed it in. Of all the literary men I have known, he was the most unliterary in his make and manner. I do not know whether he had any acquaintance with Latin, but I believe not the least. German he knew pretty well, and Italian enough late in life to have fun with it, but he used English and all its alien derivations as if it were native to his own air, as if it had come up out of American, out of Missourian ground. His style was what we know, for good and for bad, but his manner, if I may difference the two, was as entirely his own as if no one had ever written before. I have noted before this how he was not enslaved to the consecutiveness in writing which the rest of us try to keep chained to. That is, he wrote as he thought, and as all men think, without sequence, without an eye to what went before or should come after. If something beyond or beside what he was saying occurred to him, he invited it to his page, and made it as much at home there as the nature of it would suffer him. Then, when he was through with the welcoming of this casual and unexpected guest, he would go back to the company he was entertaining, and keep on with what he had been talking about. He observed this manner in the construction of his sentences, and the arrangement of his chapters, and the ordering of, or disordering, of his compilations. Nowhere is this characteristic better found than in Mark Twain's autobiography. It was not a style, it was unself-conscious thought. I helped him with a library of humor, which he once edited, and when I had done my work, according to tradition, with authors, times, and topics carefully studied in due sequence, he tore it all apart, and chucked the pieces in wherever the fancy for them took him at the moment. He was right. We were not making a textbook, but a book for the pleasure rather than the instruction of the reader. And he did not see why the principle on which he built his travels and reminiscences and tales and novels should not apply to it. And I do not see, either, though at the time it confounded me. On minor points he was, beyond any author I have known, without favorite phrases or pet words. He utterly despised the avoidance of repetitions, out of fear of tautology. If a word served his turn better than a substitute, he would use it as many times in a page as he chose. End of chapter 4. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California for LibriVox. Fall 2006. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. That's LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 5. At that time, I had become editor of the Atlantic Monthly, and I had allegiances belonging to the conduct of what was and still remains the most scrupulously cultivated of our periodicals. When Clemens began to write for it, he came willingly under its rules, for, with all his wilfulness there never was a more biddable man in things you could show him a reason for. He never made the least of that trouble which so abounds for the hapless editor from more narrow-minded contributors. If you wanted a thing changed, very good. He changed it. If you suggested that a word or a sentence or a paragraph had better be struck out, very good, he struck it out. His proof sheets came back each a veritable mush of concession, as Emerson says. Now and then he would try a little stronger language than the Atlantic had stomach for, and once when I sent him a proof, I made him observe that I had left out the profanity. He wrote back, "Mrs. Clemens opened that proof and lit into the room with danger in her eye. What profanity? You see, when I read the manuscript to her, I skipped that." It was part of his joke to pretend a violence in that gentlest creature, which the more amusingly realized the situation to their friends. I was always very glad of him and proud of him as a contributor, but I must not claim the whole merit, or the first merit, of having him write for us. It was the publisher, the late H. O. Houghton, who felt the incongruity of his absence from the leading periodical of the country, and was always urging me to get him to write. I will take the credit of being eager for him, but it is to the publisher's credit that he tried, so far as the modest traditions of the Atlantic would permit, to meet the expectations in pay which the colossal profits of Clemens's books might naturally have bred in him. Whether he was really able to do this, he never knew from Clemens himself, but probably $20 a page did not surfeit the author of books that sold right along just like the Bible. We had several short contributions from Clemens first, all of capital quality, and then we had the series of papers which went mainly to the making of his great book, Life on the Mississippi. Upon the whole, I have the notion that Clemens thought this his greatest book, and he was supported in his opinion by that of the portier in his hotel at Vienna, and that of the German emperor, who, as he told me with equal respect for the preference of each, united in thinking it his best. With such far-sundered social poles approaching in its favor, he apparently found himself without standing for opposition. At any rate, the papers won instant appreciation from his editor and publisher, and from the readers of their periodical, which they expected to prosper beyond precedent in its circulation. But those were days of simpler acceptance of the popular rights of newspapers than these are, when magazines strictly guard their vested interests against them. The New York Times and the St. Louis Democrat profited by the advance copies of the magazine sent to them to reprint the papers month by month. Together they covered nearly the whole reading territory of the Union, and the terms of their daily publication enabled them to anticipate the magazine in its own restricted field. Its subscription list was not enlarged in the slightest measure, and the Atlantic Monthly languished on the newsstands as undesired as ever. End of Chapter 5, read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California, for LibriVox, Fall 2006. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. That's LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 6. It was among my later visits to Hartford that we began to talk up the notion of collaborating a play, but we did not arrive at any clear intention, and it was a telegram out of the clear sky that one day summoned me from Boston to help with a continuation of Colonel Sellers. I had been a witness of the high joy of Clemens in the prodigious triumph of the first Colonel Sellers, which had been dramatized from the novel of The Gilded Age. This was the joint work of Clemens and Charles Dudley Warner, and the story had been put upon the page by someone in Utah whom Clemens first brought to book in the court for violation of his copyright, and then indemnified for such rights as his adaptation of the book had given him. The structure of the work, as John T. Raymond gave it, was substantially the work of this unknown dramatist. Clemens never pretended, to me at any rate, that he had the least hand in it. He frankly owned that he was incapable of dramatization, yet the vital part was his, for the characters in the play were his as the book embodied them, and the success which it won with the public was justly his. This he shared equally with the actor, following the company with an agent who counted out the author's share of the gate money and sent him a note of the amount every day by postal card. The postals used to come about dinner time, and Clemens would read them aloud to us in wild triumph. $150, $200, $300 were the gay figures which they bore, and which he flaunted in the air before he sat down at table, or rose from it to brandish, and then, flinging his napkin into his chair, walked up and down to exult in. By and by, the popularity of the play waned, and the time came when he sickened of the whole affair, and withdrew his agent, and took whatever gain from it the actor apportioned him. He was apt to have these sudden surceases, following upon the intensities of his earlier interest, though he seemed always to have the notion of making something more of Colonel Sellers. But when I arrived in Hartford in answer to his summons, I found him with no definite idea of what he wanted to do with him. I represented that we must have some sort of plan, and he agreed that we should both jot down a scenario overnight and compare our respective schemes the next morning. As the author of a large number of little plays, which have been privately presented throughout the United States and in parts of the United Kingdom, without ever getting upon the public stage except for the noble ends of charity, and then promptly getting off it, I felt authorized to make him observe that his scheme was as nearly nothing as chaos could be. He agreed hilariously with me, and was willing to let it stand in proof of his entire dramatic inability. At the same time, he liked my plot very much, which ultimated Sellers, according to Clemens' intention, as a man crazed by his own inventions and by his superstition that he was the rightful heir to an English earldom. The exuberant nature of Sellers and the vast range of his imagination served our purpose in other ways. Clemens made him a spiritualist, whose specialty in the occult was materialization. He became, on impulse, an ardent temperance reformer, and he headed a procession of temperance ladies, after disinterestedly testing the deleterious effects of liquor upon himself until he could not walk straight. Always he wore a marvelous fire extinguisher strapped on his back to give him proof in any emergency of the effectiveness of his invention in that way. We had a jubilant fortnight in working the particulars of these things out. It was not possible for Clemens to write like anybody else, but I could very easily write like Clemens, and we took the play seen and seen about, quite secure and coming out in temperamental agreement. The characters remained, for the most part, his, and I varied them only to make them more like his than, if possible, he could. Several years after that, when I looked over a copy of the play, I could not always tell my work from his. I only knew that I had done certain scenes. We would work all day long at our several tasks, and then at night, before dinner, read them over to each other. No dramatists ever got greater joy out of their creations, and when I reflect that the public never had the chance of sharing our joy, I pity the public from a full heart. I still believe that the play was immensely funny. I still believe that if it could once have got behind the footlights, it would have continued to pack the house before them for an indefinite succession of nights. But this may be my fondness. At any rate, it was not to be. Raymond had identified himself with Sellers in the play-going imagination, and whether consciously or unconsciously, we constantly worked with Raymond in our minds. But before this time, bitter displeasures had risen between Clemens and Raymond, and Clemens was determined that Raymond should never have the play. He first offered it to several other actors, who eagerly caught it, only to give it back with the despairing renunciation, "That is a Raymond play." We tried managers with it, but their only question was whether they could get Raymond to do it. In the meantime, Raymond had provided himself with a play for the winter, a very good play by Demarest Lloyd, and he was in no hurry for ours. Perhaps he did not really care for it. Perhaps he knew, when he heard of it, that it must come to him in the end. In the end it did, from my hand, for Clemens would not meet him. I found him in a mood of sweet reasonableness, perhaps the more softened by one of those lunches with our publisher. The hospitable James R. Osgood was always bringing people together over in Boston. He said that he could not do the play that winter, but he was sure that he would like it, and he had no doubt he would do it the next winter. So I gave him the manuscript, in spite of Clemens' charges, for his suspicions and rancors were such that he would not have had me leave it for a moment in the actor's hands. But it seemed a conclusion that involved success and fortune for us. In due time, but I do not remember how long after, Raymond declared himself delighted with the piece. He entered into a satisfactory agreement for it, and at the beginning of the next season he started with it to Buffalo, where he was to give a first production. At Rochester he paused long enough to return it, with the explanation that a friend had noted to him the fact that Colonel Sellers in the play was a lunatic, and insanity was so serious a thing that it could not be represented on the stage without outraging the sensibilities of the audience, or words to that effect. We were too far off to allege Hamlet to the contrary, or King Lear, or to instance the delight which generations of readers throughout the world had taken in the mad freaks of Don Quixote. Whatever were the real reasons of Raymond for rejecting the play, we had to be content with those he gave, and to set about getting it into other hands. In this effort we failed even more signally than before, if that were possible. At last a clever and charming elocutionist, who had long wished to get himself on the stage, heard of it and asked to see it. We would have shown it to anyone by this time, and we very willingly showed it to him. He came to Hartford and did some scenes from it for us. I must say he did them very well, quite as well as Raymond could have done them, in whose manner he did them. But now, late towards spring, the question was where he could get an engagement with the play, and we ended by hiring a theater in New York for a week of trial performances. Clemens came on with me to Boston, where we were going to make some changes in the piece, and where we made them to our satisfaction, but not to the effect of that high rapture which we had in the first draft. He went back to Hartford, and then the cold fit came upon me, and in visions of the night, in slumberings upon bed, ghastly forms of failure appalled me, and when I rose in the morning I wrote him, "Here is a play which every manager has put out of doors, and which every actor known to us has refused, and now we go and give it to an elocutioner. We are fools." Whether Clemens agreed with me or not in my conclusion, he agreed with me in my premises, and we promptly bought the play off the stage at a cost of $700, which we shared between us. But Clemens was never a man to give up. I relinquished gratis all right and title I had in the play, and he paid its entire expenses for a week of one-night stands in the country. It never came to New York, and yet I think now that if it had come, it would have succeeded. So hard does the faith of the unsuccessful dramatist in his work die. End of chapter 6. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California for LibriVox. Fall 2006. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 7. There is an incident of this time so characteristic of both men that I will yield to the temptation of giving it here. After I had gone to Hartford in response to Clemens' telegram, Matthew Arnold arrived in Boston, and one of my family called on his, to explain why I was not at home to receive his introduction. I had gone to see Mark Twain. "Oh, but he doesn't like that sort of thing, does he?" "He likes Mr. Clemens very much," my representative answered, "and he thinks him one of the greatest men he ever knew." I was still Clemens' guest at Hartford when Arnold came there to lecture, and one night we went to meet him at a reception. While his hand laxly held mine in greeting, I saw his eyes fixed intensely on the other side of the room. Who in the world is that?" I looked and said, "Oh, that is Mark Twain." I do not remember just how their instant encounter was contrived by Arnold's wish, but I have the impression that they were not parted for long during the evening, and the next night Arnold, as if still under the glamour of that potent presence, was at Clemens' house. I cannot say how they got on, or what they made of each other. If Clemens ever spoke of Arnold, I do not recall what he said, but Arnold had shown a sense of him from which the incredulous sniff of the polite world, now so universally exploded, had already perished. It might well have done so with his first dramatic vision of that prodigious head. Clemens was then hard upon 50, and he had kept, as he did to the end, the slender figure of his youth. But the ashes of the burnt-out years were beginning to gray the fires of that splendid shock of red hair, which he held to the height of a stature apparently greater than it was, and tilted from side to side in his undulating walk. He glimmered at you from the narrow slits of fine, blue-greenish eyes, under branching brows, which with age grew more and more like a sort of plumage, and he was apt to smile into your face with a subtle but amiable perception, and yet with a sort of remote absence. You were all there for him, But he was not all there for you. End of chapter 7, read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California, for LibriVox, fall 2006. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 8. I shall not try to give chronological order to my recollections of him, but since I am just now with him in Hartford, I will speak of him in association with the place. Once, when I came on from Cambridge, he followed me to my room to see that the water was not frozen in my bath, or something of the kind, for it was very cold weather, and then hospitably lingered. Not to lose time in banalities, I began at once from the thread of thought in my mind. I wonder why we hate the past so. And he responded from the depths of his own consciousness. It's so damned humiliating, which is what any man would say of his past, if he were honest. But honest men are few when it comes to themselves. Clemens was one of the few, and the first of them among all people I have known. I have known, I suppose, men as truthful, but not so promptly, so absolutely, so positively, so almost aggressively truthful. He could lie, of course, and did to save others from grief or harm. He was not stupidly truthful, but his first impulse was to say out the thing and everything that was in him. To those who can understand, it will not be contradictory of his sense of humiliation from the past that he was not ashamed for anything he ever did, to the point of wishing to hide it. He could be, and he was, bitterly sorry for his errors, which he had enough of in his life, but he was not ashamed in that mean way. What he had done, he owned to, good, bad, or indifferent, and if it was bad, he was rather amused than troubled as to the effect in your mind. He would not obtrude the fact upon you, but if it were in the way of personal history, he would not dream of withholding it, far less from hiding it. He was the readiest of men to allow an error, if he were found in it. In one of our walks about Hartford, when he was in the first fine flush of his agnosticism, he declared that Christianity had done nothing to improve morals and conditions, and that the world under the highest pagan civilization was as well off as it was under the highest Christian influences. I happened to be fresh from the reading of Charles Loring Brace's Gesta Christi, or History of Humane Progress, and I could offer him abundant proofs that he was wrong. He did not like that, evidently, but he instantly gave way, saying he had not known those things. Later, he was more tolerant in his denials of Christianity, but just then he was feeling his freedom from it, and rejoicing from having broken what he felt to have been the shackles of belief worn so long. He greatly admired Robert Ingersoll, whom he called an angelic orator, and regarded him as an evangel of a new gospel, the gospel of free thought. He took the warmest interest in the newspaper controversy raging at the time as to the existence of a hell. When the noes carried the day, I suppose that no enemy of perdition was more pleased. He still loved his old friend and pastor, Mr. Twitchell, but he no longer went to hear him preach his sage and beautiful sermons, and was, I think, thereby the greater loser. Long before that, I had asked him if he went regularly to church, and he groaned out, "Oh, yes, I go. It most kills me, but I go." And I did not need his telling me to understand that he went because his wife wished it. He did tell me, after they both ceased to go, that it had finally come to her, saying, "Well, if you are to be lost, I want to be lost with you." He could accept that willingness for supreme sacrifice and exult in it because of the supreme truth as he saw it. After they had both ceased to be formal Christians, she was still grieved by his denial of immortality, so grieved that he resolved upon one of those heroic lies which for love's sake he held above even the truth, and he went to her, saying that he had been thinking the whole matter over, and now he was convinced that the soul did live after death. It was too late. Her keen vision pierced through his ruse, as it did when he brought the doctor who had diagnosticated her case as organic disease of the heart, and after making him go over the facts of it again with her, made him declare it merely functional. To make an end of these records as to Clemens' beliefs, so far as I knew them, I should say that he never went back to anything like faith in the Christian theology, or in the notion of life after death, or in a conscious divinity. It is best to be honest in this matter. He would have hated anything else, and I do not believe that the truth in it hurt anyone. At one period he argued that there must have been a cause, a conscious source of things, that the universe could not have come by chance. I have heard also that in his last hours or moments he said, or his dearest ones hoped he had said, something about meeting again. But the expression, of which they could not be certain, was of the vaguest, and he was perhaps addressed to their tenderness out of his tenderness. All his expressions to me were of a courageous renunciation of any hope of living again, or elsewhere seeing those he had lost. He suffered terribly in their loss, and he was not fool enough to try ignoring his grief. He knew that, for this, there were but two medicines, that it would wear itself out with the years, and that, meanwhile, there was nothing for it but those respites in which the mourner forgets himself in slumber. I remember that, in a black hour of my own, when I was called down to see him, as he thought, from sleep, he said with an infinite and exquisite compassion, "Oh, did I wake you? Did I wake you?" Nothing more. But the look, the voice, were everything, and while I live, they cannot pass from my sense. End of Chapter 8. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California for LibriVox. Fall 2006. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 9. He was the most caressing of men in his pity, but he had the fine instinct, which would have pleased Lowell, of never putting his hands on you. Fine, delicate hands with taper fingers and pink nails, like a girl's, and sensitively quivering in moments of emotion. He did not paw you with them to show his affection, as so many of us Americans are apt to do. Among the half-dozen or half-hundred personalities that each of us becomes, I should say that Clemens' central and final personality was something exquisite. His casual acquaintance might know him, perhaps, from his fierce intensity, his wild pleasure in shocking people with his ribaldries and profanities, or from the mere need of loosing his rebellious spirit in that way, as anything but exquisite. And yet that was what, in the last analysis, he was. They might come away loathing or hating him, but one could not know him well without realizing him the most serious, the most humane, the most conscientious of men. He was Southwestern, and born amid the oppression of a race that had no rights as against ours. But I never saw a man more regardful of Negroes. He had a yellow butler when I first began to know him, because he said he could not bear to order a white man about. But the terms of his ordering George were those of the softest entreaty which command ever wore. He loved to rely upon George, who was such a broken reed in some things, though so staunch in others, and the fervent Republican in politics that Clemens then liked him to be. He could interpret Clemens' meaning to the public without conveying his mood, and could render his roughest answer smooth to the person denied his presence. His general instructions were that this presence was to be denied all but personal friends, but the soft heart of George was sometimes touched by importunity, and once he came up into the billiard room saying that Mr. Smith wished to see Clemens. Upon inquiry, Mr. Smith developed no ties of friendship, and Clemens said, "You go and tell Mr. Smith that I wouldn't come down to see the 12 apostles." George turned from the threshold where he had kept himself and framed a paraphrase of this message, which apparently sent Mr. Smith away content with himself and all the rest of the world. The part of him that was Western in his Southwestern origin, Clemens kept to the end. But he was the most de-Southernized Southerner I ever knew. No man more perfectly sensed and more entirely abhorred slavery, and no one has ever poured such scorn upon the second-hand, Walter Scotticized, pseudo-chivalry of the Southern ideal. He held himself responsible for the wrong which the white race had done the black race in slavery, and, he explained, in paying the way of a Negro student through Yale, that he was doing it as his part of the reparation due from every white to every black man. He said he had never seen this student, nor ever wished to see him or know his name. It was quite enough that he was a Negro. About that time, a colored cadet was expelled from West Point for some point of conduct unbecoming an officer and gentleman, and there was the usual shabby philosophy in a portion of the press to the effect that a Negro could never feel the claim of honor. The man was 15 parts white, but, oh yes, Clemens said with bitter irony, it was that one part black that undid him. It made him a nigger and incapable of being a gentleman. It was to blame for the whole thing. The 15 parts white were guiltless. Clemens was entirely satisfied with the result of the Civil War, and he was eager to have its facts and meanings brought out at once in history. He ridiculed the notion held by many that it was not yet time to philosophize the events of the great struggle, that we must wait till its passions have cooled and the clouds of strife had cleared away. He maintained that the time would never come when we should see its motives and men and deeds more clearly, and that now was the hour to ascertain them in lasting verity. Picturesquely and dramatically, he portrayed the imbecility of deferring the inquiry at any point to the distance of future years, when, inevitably, the facts would begin to put on fable. He had powers of sarcasm and a relentless rancor in his contempt which those who knew him best appreciated most. The late Noah Brooks, who had been in California at the beginning of Clemens' career and had witnessed the effect of his ridicule before he had learned to temper it, once said to me that he would rather have any one else in the world down on him than Mark Twain. But as Clemens grew older, he grew more merciful, not to the wrong, but to the men who were in it. The wrong was often the source of his wildest drolling. He considered it such hopelessness of ever doing it justice that his despair broke in laughter. End of chapter 9. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California, for LibriVox, Fall 2006.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.